This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
So let's talk movies. Paul, on this email, after listening to Mark's review, I went to see 30 Days of Night with my wife last week. I really enjoyed the film, found it quite creepy. Nice twist on the usual tired vampire film. Not a wooden stake or bottle of holy water in sight. However, I was mortified to find that a certain well-known movie review site had only awarded the film a lukewarm 51%. Why is it the most po-faced critics refuse to give horror films any credit whatsoever? I attend the cinema to be entertained, not to be force-fed some artsy social realism or starchy period drama. Anyway, then there's an ellipsis and he stops.
So. Yeah, no, but I mean, it is true that there was a lot of snotty reviews of that film. I mean, I think there were things wrong with it, but I like David Slade very much. And if you've seen that and if you haven't seen Hard Candy yet, then go and see Hard Candy, because Hard Candy is just a terrific movie. It's so edgy and it's so much... Have you ever seen Videodrome, the David Cronenberg movie?
Yes, many years ago.
Okay. There's a line in Videodrome...
good friend David.
Yes, he speaks highly of you. And, incidentally, Kenneth Branagh says hi. Kenneth Branagh.
No, he didn't.
No, he did. He's the first thing I said. I was with Kenneth Branagh this morning, and the very first
Ken,
the very first thing he said to me was, he said, "I just got to ask you, you and Simon, you really hate each other?" I said, "No, it's an act." I said, "Yes, we do." And it was, so there's a line in Videodrome in which this woman was, and I've lived with her. She says, "You have to understand." She says it in a German accent, which I can't do because all my German accents sound like
Werner Herzog.
They all sound like Werner Herzog. She said, "The reason Videodrome is dangerous is because it has a philosophy. That is what you do not have, Max." And that's absolutely true of Hard Candy. And I do like 30 Days of Night, but see Hard Candy because that is the distilled essence of what they're about.
Do you think we should add Ken Branagh to the hello list?
I think we should. I love him. I mean, I think it'd be a good bit.
Actually, on that kind of slightly in situation, Jonathan Pryce was here, fantastic, as our guest after 2 o'clock.
Sam Lowry.
And at the end, I went and said, "Thanks very much. That was great." He said, "Dave Morrissey says hi." So I thought, hey, that's very
excellent.
Good. So I'm inclined to add, do you think Ken, we can't accept Ken and Jonathan into the Academy, can we?
Well, I don't see why not. I mean, I think definitely Kenneth we have to, because,
Okay, well, why don't we do Kenneth? I suspect Jonathan's a bit... He's not a podcaster.
No. And anyway, as he went out, he walked past me and he said, "I shan't be listening this afternoon." I think he meant because he was busy.
Right. Maybe he just doesn't like you.
Yeah, maybe told him that I called Keira Knightley IKEA.
That's true. And certainly Jonathan Pryce doesn't want to work with Werner Herzog. Because at the beginning of the interview, he said it was Werner Herzog in the building. I said, no. I said, "Do you want to work with him?" He said, "Not really, no." this from Sam in Tunbridge. Having listened last week, I took the good doctor's prescription and headed over to the Odeon in Panton Street in London to see Bug.
Oh, God bless you.
An odd movie.
Yes.
It's certainly one to recommend. No, great performances. Who knew Ashley Judd was that good?
Exactly.
A real sense of dread and some very nasty moments add up to a strong movie, even if it does feel a bit stagey. It's a shame it has already departed cinema screens, but it ought to be on DVD soon. It's well worth a look if you aren't squeamish. So cheers to the doctor for recommending the highlight of my week at the cinema.
No, well, look, I'm really glad that somebody did go and see it projected. It is a little bit stagey in that it is adapted from a stage play by Tracy Lett. I think it's Friedkin's best work since Cruising. I mean, absolutely, with Ashley Judd, who knew that she had that kind of raw vitality in it? Because she's been in a lot of very, very bland movies. The thing I always forget about Ashley Judd is she's of the family of the Judds. You know the Judds?
The singing Judds?
Yeah. She's the other one. She's the one who doesn't sing.
The one who can't sing.
Oh, she probably can
got thrown
sing as well.
Out.
No, she probably can sing. Well, the first thing I ever saw her in was Ruby in Paradise, in which I thought she's fine. But I never knew that she had that kind of edge to her that she displays in Bug. And I think it's a real crying shame that film has literally been dumped in for 1 week. And as your listener there says, gone already. It'll come straight out on DVD. It's already out on DVD in America. After playing to, a really exciting reception in Cannes, in that people who liked it really liked it and people who hated it really hated it. Jonathan Romney, who's a very prominent critic in the UK, came up, bounded up to me in the Croisette in Cannes and said, "I've just seen Bug. It's terrible. You'll love it."
So there it is, the entire movie world of critics summed up in one pithy phrase. Yeah. Are we doing Death at a Funeral today?
Oh, no, I'm sorry, I didn't make it
okay,
yet.
Okay, right,
I haven't
here we
done
go.
It yet, but I must do, because, in fact, somebody wrote in an email which said, actually, they went to see it, and it's not bad at all.
Okay, well, here's Richard in Knotts, who says, "Simon and the Good Doctor, before..."
I haven't made it yet.
"Mark Paul's scorn all over Death at the Funeral. We'll have to, it sounds like they might have to wait for
that. We will have to wait, sorry.
Asserting it to be the worst film this year. Let it be known how utterly wrong he is. It is, in a lot of people's opinion, one of the best comedy films this year. I went to see it last Friday. Couldn't stop laughing throughout. It definitely passed the 5 laughs a minute test, unlike Run, Fat Boy, Run. And judging by the reaction of the audience, they enjoyed it too. Just because you self-righteous critics don't get it, this is based on something that you haven't
said. Done yet. Yeah.
That we, Joe Public, won't find it funny. Yes, it was outrageously balmy. Yes, there were a lot of toilet humour there. And yes, the funniest part was a man hallucinating after mistakenly taking acid. But it was hilarious.
Yeah, well, look, as I said...
He's cross about that, but...
No, I'm certainly open-minded to it. Certainly, never judge anything until you've seen it. On the subject of which, incidentally, if anyone's seen Om Shanti Om, please send us in a review, because that shows up in the charts this week, which wasn't national press shown, and I'd like to know. I mean, I'll go and see that this weekend, but if you've seen it already because it opened last week, please send us in a review. A short pithy would do good, in the same way that I do short.
Yeah, okay, so Om Shanti Om, 85058, mail at bbc.co.uk, because it's in the top 10, which we'll do. By the way, reviews coming up for American Gangster, which I feel as though we've been talking about for weeks, actually, on the programme.
Oh, sorry. Forgive me.
Yeah. Beowulf. Yeah. Brick
Beowulf.
Lane.
Beowulf.
Pardon?
Beowulf.
Beowulf.
What is that like? Does he come in steins? You like six-pack of Beowulf?
How are you saying it?
Beowulf.
Beowulf.
Or Beowulf, if you want, but not Beowulf. Ginger Beowulf by Ray Winston. You calling me a Ginger Beowulf?
Brick Lane, Jane Austen Book Club, Weirdsville, various other bits and pieces. But the top 10 this week... Like this, at 10, Into the Wild.
Which, I like, with the reservation only being that if Werner Herzog had directed it, it would have been slightly better. Because as it is, Sean Penn has this absolute love of nature and, it's this story about this guy going off into the wild. And Sean Penn does direct it in a slightly dewy-eyed fashion, or a very honest dewy-eyed fashion. You know that if Herzog had done it, which he kind of did the same thing with Grizzly Man, it just would have been like this, the wild, it is all impenetrable and full of death and misery. And I sort of tend towards that.
Do you think there are many actors like Jonathan Pryce who, if given the opportunity to work with Werner, would say no, thank you?
No, I mean, I can't understand why not. I mean, being dragged halfway up the jungle and shot at by Peruvians, I think it's a fine thing.
Would you be prepared
to eat a steak? As Werner said, I interviewed him on stage, and he said, I want to put the record straight. In all the 55 movies I have made, no actor has ever been harmed. Crew members, yes, but not actors.
Eastern Promises at 9.
I still, I'm such a big fan of Cronenberg. Funnily enough, I'm going to go and see it again because when I first saw it, I wasn't sure if it was quite on the same standard as History of Violence. And since then, a couple of people have really disliked it, which always makes me want to go back and see something again. I suspect I may like it even more. But it's worth it for the Viggo Mortensen performance, and the naked male wrestling in the steam bath and the tattoos is one of the highlights of the year.
I'm not sure if I could take it if you were found to be wrong about something else, because, it would be another pillar shaken.
Really?
In the edifice of life. Yeah, we've been wrong about so many things recently.
Have I?
Yeah, well, you've confessed to that. Yeah,
no,
you've
changed your mind. Yeah, I'm going through a midlife maturing process.
Saw 4 at 8.
Why are we bothering with this? And worst of all, I think it's not going to stop. I mean, at a time in which Saw 4 can open in 100 cinemas and Bug can open in 1, it's depressing. And if you went to see Saw 4, you've brought this upon yourself. These decisions are made by the audience to some extent. If you don't want the cinema to be cluttered with that kind of rubbish and you do want to see an interesting range of movies, then pay to go and see Bug. Although you can't now because it's off. Thanks.
So it wasn't much of a deal anyway, as it was only on in one cinema.
It's a sort of Sisyphean task, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a what?
No, Sisyphus pushing... Never mind.
Om Shanti Om there at 7, yeah, and reviews to come. Lions for Lambs at 6.
I like this much more than many of the critics who I've read since. I mean, I think it's an interesting drama. I like Robert Redford very much. It's very well crafted. It's put together solidly. It's like 90 minutes long. It covers very many subjects in terms of, war and peace and politics, and its central message is, look, get engaged. I've read so many reviews since I saw it saying it's just a bunch of people talking and it's just lecturing and it's smug and all the rest of it. I don't agree with any of that. I think it's much more dramatically engaging than people think.
So its central message is get engaged.
Get engaged, yeah. Not get engaged as in I love you, please live with me for the rest of your life. Yes, its central message is that person sitting next to you, marry them.
Marry them straight away. 30 days
Loins for Lambs.
30 Days of Night at number 5.
I think we've covered that.
Elizabeth, the Golden Age of Four. I want to see this.
Elizabeth, the made-up version with Elizabeth on horseback in the shining armour and Sir Walter swinging nimbly from flaming boat to flaming boat. And at one point, leaping underwater as the Spanish beard is singed and looking up from under the sea to see the Spanish beard being singed. Here's my question. Can you do that? Didn't salt water get in your eyes? If you open your eyes under... I mean, that's the mouth of the Thames, presumably, but you can't do that, right? You need goggles. I mean, unless he'd actually leapt into the sea with a pair of Speedo goggles that he whipped out of his backpack and put on so he could look up and see the Spanish beard being
singed. I think some people have their eyes open underwater.
What, fish?
No, people.
What, in salt water?
Shall we find out?
Yeah, tell me anyone who can see underwater in the sea without goggles.
Especially if you've done that and witnessed the singeing
of the Spanish beard, metaphorically, obviously.
Ratatouille at number three.
Again, you know, better the second time round, but still overly long and still nothing like the masterpiece that it perhaps ought to be. The kids were charmed by it.
Alvin Stardust at number two.
And, you know, good, creaky round the edges, lots of things wrong with it, but, you know, its heart's in the right place. Personally, I think Robert De Niro overdoes it as the cross-dressing pirate king, but it's fine, and I was rather charmed by it.
And maybe a moment's silence as we acknowledge the number one movie, as advertised in a phone box near you. Good luck, Chuck.
I mean, you brought it upon yourselves. You have no one to blame. It's like the day after election when you turn around and look at the people that are running the country. I mean, all I can say is, you know, hey, you did it.
It's not good, though, is it, really?
No, it's horrible. It's a horrible film. I mean, it's a really, really horrible film.
So, and we'll continue this in just a moment. The email's to mail@bbc.co.uk. Beowulf. Beowulf?
Beowulf.
Beowulf.
Like bear... Wolf.
I've got that. Okay, so that
review...
How would
you say it?
Beowulf.
Yeah. Beowulf.
Look, ooh, sorry, Simon.
Excuse me, Mama. I'm off to read Beowulf. And then I'm going to play the grand piano.
I'm sure Seamus Heaney said Beowulf.
Yeah, well, you know, Seamus Heaney can say what he likes. He's big.
Yes. He also translated it.
Yeah, into what?
English.
It was
the language out of which we usually speak.
Right, okay, well, it's Beowulf.
Eva in Glasgow, Om Shanti Om is great.
Great.
It is an homage to Bollywood's amazing 70s high time and one big celebration of Shah Rukh Khan. Very ironic, full of inside humour and really good fun. I loved it.
Thank you. Why did you pause over good fun?
Because I was correcting a grammatical error.
What?
As I
goodly
was
fun.
MC in Brighton, Herzog is a legend. Every sentence he has uttered in this great interview has increased my respect and admiration for him. And I didn't think that was possible. Is it Aguirreth of God? Is that
Aguirreth of God, yeah.
You correcting my pronunciation, just wanted to make sure it's right. Is the finest film ever made. It's time it was recognised as such. Bob on this says, the two of you, the Werner Herzog, was great. Werner seems to have a lot to say. It's a shame you couldn't continue the interview longer. A minority view, it has to be said.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Tim in Exeter, I hate Mark's rants about Saw 4. I've loved all of the movies, and I thought it was ace and can't wait for Saw 5.
Well, you know, I mean, here's the only thing I'd say about the Saw series is it started at a level of artistic bankruptcy and it went downhill from there.
Let's kick off with Beowulf.
Beowulf.
Lee and Shrewsbury on this, just to get things going.
Okay.
Then over to the Good Doctor on this. Saw Beowulf with my sons, 23 and 14.
Oh, right.
Funny names.
Yeah.
Great film, but not for the faint of stomach. Using CGI to get a 12A rating is very clever, but it is so realistic that under 12s might find this a bit harsh, and some of the content far too adult. 3D was good fun, one or two jumpy moments. Overall, very enjoyable. £2 for the glasses, though. What do you make of it? Doctor.
Okay, we'll come to the rating in a little bit. Incidentally, the screening that I saw, because Beowulf is available in Real D, in Dobbly Digital 3D, did it in Dobbly, and in IMAX 3D. And the version that I saw that was press shown was the IMAX 3D, which, cause, of course, you know, the screen is the size of a house and is incredibly clear, and you get the great big glasses, which I imagine the 3D works on, what do you call it?
A screen?
No, not on a screen. Rather than the colour process, which is red and green, there's the one. What's it when one set of wavelengths go like that and the other set of wavelengths go like that? You know, they have your
crisscross
glasses.
Quiz?
No, it'll come to me in a moment. Anyway, there's the other way of doing it, okay? So,
a migraine?
I saw it in the biggest, loudest, jazziest version that it's possible to see it in. Directed by Robert Zemeckis, who did Who Killed Roger Rabbit, Forrest Gump, about which we've argued in the past, and I suppose significantly Polar Express, which at the time was seen as a fairly significant breakthrough in mocap. or performance capture, as the actors prefer it to be called. I mean, particularly in the case of, you know, Andy Serkis and his work. And you probably know this anyway, but in case you don't, what happens is that the actors are sort of digitally mapped and then turned into a digitized image. So you get a hybrid between real life and animation that's something like what used to be called rotoscoping, in which you'd film and then you'd draw around the film to give a kind of, you know, very realistic impression. That goes back to Walt Disney and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Anyway, in the past, people have taken on Beowulf, include Christopher Lambert. This time, Beowulf is played by Ray Winston. Ray Winston, he gets off the boat and he says, "I'm Beowulf. I've come here to get your monster. Are you having a bit of trouble with some monsters?" And Sir Anthony Hopkins is indeed having a bit of trouble with some monsters.
How many impressions are we going to get in one movie?
Okay, here's a clip which has got Ray Winston and Sir Anthony Hopkins discussing the ongoing problem of, once you've dealt with Grendel, then you've got to deal with the mum.
"You brought back the head of Grendel. What about the head of the mother?"
"With her dead and cold in the bog, is it not enough to return one monster's head?"
"Did you kill her?"
"Would you like to hear the story of my struggle against this monstrous hag?"
"She's no hag, Beowulf. We both know that. But answer me. Did you kill her?"
"Would I have been able to escape her had I not?"
"Grendel is dead. That's all that matters to me. He can bother me no more. The mother, the hag, she's not my curse. Not anymore."
Nice to hear the Irish pipes playing in the background.
Yeah, although I think the accent that Sir Anthony was doing was Welsh, and the one that Beowulf was doing was clearly, you know, Scandinavian via the East End.
Yes.
So at the screening that I saw, a very, very nice woman came up and introduced herself to me as the woman who wrote in from Cambridge, and whose name now completely fails me. If you're listening, please text me what your name was, who had sent in a text before saying that I was completely right about that thing about novellas. You remember that? And the Heidegger, Freudian, King, and the Finnish bit. But apparently I disagreed with her on the basis that... Oh, no, she's from Oxford. And I disagreed with her on the basis that she was from Oxford, and I was automatically siding with Cambridge for reasons of filial loyalty, which is just completely stupid. Anyway... we were sitting there, and it was great fun. And she knows her stuff, obviously. And she was reading the press notes. And as she was reading the press notes, at one point she let out a guffaw, which sort of seemed to suggest that if you really knew your Anglo-Saxon, even before you got into the cinema, we were going to be departing from the original text in ways which perhaps not entirely acceptable to everyone. Now, I read Beowulf when I was at college, because when I went to Manchester University, and they start you, if you do English, they start you with like the first ever writing.
The Seamus Heaney translation?
No. No, you do Anglo-Saxon, not the Seamus Heaney translation, the Anglo-Saxon translation from Anglo-Saxon. And then you read it. And of course,
I was in the fourth set.
When you translate any of that stuff, most Anglo-Saxon reads like, "The man who was inside went outside, and then he said forth words from his lips, which went forth like arrows coming out of his lips from the mouth that out of which they came." And it's like 48 things that mean he said, "Hi, I'm just going off to go and kill Grendel," right? Zemeckis has said that when he first read Beowulf, he didn't have any interest in it at all and found it really, really boring because he had to read it at school. And he said, "And anyway, I couldn't understand it because it was in Old English." Well, the modern version is very much in modern English. And it's a script by Neil Gaiman and Roger Avery. So you're talking about, you know, somebody who contributed to Pulp Fiction and Stardust, I suppose. And the modern English includes such colloquialisms as the word which sounds like Scrollocks, the word, you know, which is referred to as J. Arthur. I was genuinely surprised by how earthy, and I have rather inappropriately earthy for a 12 certificate sometimes, the language was. But anyway, you know, it's sort of ripping, and it's okay, let's put it into language that the kids can understand, in pretty much the same way as the Good News Bible. You ever read the Good News Bible? You know, the one that's kind of like, "Hey, wow, Jesus came down and said, hey, what are you cats doing?"
That's the one with sort of pinline drawings of
that's right, yeah, and it's characters. Like, you know, let me lay some truth on you, man.
I think you're exaggerating your case.
Okay, fine, well, you know, give me King James any day. But the language here, although there are little bits which sort of seem to echo something which sounds like a garbled version of Anglo-Saxon, is basically a lot more kind of earthy. Now, it's done in animated CG, and the animated CG is particularly fleshy. I mean, it's impossible to watch it without thinking two things. Firstly, the flesh tones in this movie are really, really fantastically well rendered. And secondly, I think we're probably about 2 years away from mainstream CG pornography, because it's the sense that you get is, blimey, they've really, really worked hard on that fleshiness. The other thing is, which is strange, is that there is a surprising amount of nudity. And in the very first battle at Beowulf, Beowulf turns up, played by Ray Winston, takes off his clothes, right, and he's got the body of Adonis. Ray Winston, with the best will in the world, clearly doesn't have the body of Adonis, and it shows you why you would want to be a synthespian. If you are a synthespian, you can be bronzed and six-packed, and you speak like Ray Winston, but, you know, you look like that guy who just climbs out of the sea in the Calvin Klein advert. The whole of the first battle is done as an extended Austin Powers gag, that he's running around completely in the buff as digital nature intended, but every time he falls, you know, a helmet or a club or a sausage or a, you know, a glass of ale will stand in the way, and it's really baffling because it's like a 6-minute fight sequence, and all you can think is they've really worked hard to do this as an extended gag about the fact that he's, you know, that he's in the nude, but it's a 12 rated film. Then we start on the violence, and the violence is positively flesh ripping, and in 3D, great big 3D, it's really, really full on. There's a lovely thing from the BBFC thing which they're explaining their verdict. They say, I'm giving it a 12, there is little human to human violence, although at one point a man is torn apart by a monster. Yeah, and I would say that was sort of fairly full-on human-to-human violence.
So that makes it fantasy violence, doesn't it? So we
I'm not entirely convinced by that. It also says on the subject of sexuality, the film contains a number of moderate sex references. These mostly comprise bawdy, good-humoured singing and boasting about wenches. There's also a discreet seduction scene in which a largely naked woman makes gestures that subtly imply, and I'm not even going to read to you what it subtly implies. All I can say is, 12...
So that means anyone can go in with
it. It does. And I mean, look, I hate to appear like the biggest prude on the block. 12? I'm sorry. You know, I'm sure that there are very good reasons for all this.
Doesn't Angelina Jolie...
Angelina Jolie, right, plays the mum. She is digitally enhanced, but she plays the mum. And what happens in this... One of the things that the screenwriter said is that we wanted to address for the first time... Grendel's father, never been addressed before. In fact, Neil Gaiman, he says, why is it that nobody has ever raised the question of Grendel's father? Because it turns out they have. There are previous movies that have raised it, although in sort of slightly different ways. But in this one, the whole thing is based on a kind of cyclical Oedipal thing, which consists of Hrothgar and Beowulf confronting Grendel's mum, who turns out to be played by Angelina Jolie, looking like an advert for, you know, what's that company who make the exotic lingerie run by Malcolm McLaren's son?
Agent Provocateur.
Exactly. Coming out
apparently.
Of the swamp. The world's only high-heeled cloven hoof. I mean, how did that happen? And Angelina, she's like this. Hello, I am Angelina. No, I'm not Angelina. I'm Grendel's mother. Come to me. And digitally, 3D, Angelina Jolie in 3D. Fill in the blanks yourself.
In 3D and nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, she's not naked because she's a lizard, obviously. I mean, she's lizard-like, right? But so here's what I'm saying, in short. If you are going to get puritanical about the poem, obviously it departs from the original version, and I'm basing this partly on the stuff that I know about for reading and partly on the fantastic scoffing of somebody much more intelligent than me who I was there with, who's from Oxford and knows. Secondly, I think 12 certificate is Lee. I really thought halfway through, this is very interesting, they've clearly decided to go for the 15 certificate route in terms of the violence, the swearing and the sexuality. And I was genuinely surprised to find that it was a 12A. And thirdly, just in terms of handing over your money and getting your 3D bangs for your bucks, you know what? With all the things that are wrong with it, it really chucks everything in the kitchen sink at the screen. And I can't say that I went out feeling unsatisfied with having got my, you know, whatever it is, £7 or £8 or £10 worth of stuff in the face. I mean, again, the very first 3D movie was Buona Devil, wasn't it? Which offered you a lion in your lap. This offers you Angelina Jolie, Ray Winston and Sir Anthony Hopkins in your lap. And I mean, really full there in full on digital. So if you're going to go and see it, go and see it in the IMAX version, because it's a big, dumb movie and you want to see it in the biggest, dumbest format possible.
So pick your biggest and dumbest friends.
But don't take kids. I mean, unless they're very advanced... No, not advanced. Unless childhood has been all but trampled underfoot and we are now in a world in which everyone's grown up at the age of 6.
When I was trying to work out what people might want to get involved with, what they might text and email about, Sophie and Ali, I'll be with you in a moment, looking at me as if thinking, when are we going to get on? I never thought that actually the main source of correspondence would be, can you open your eyes underwater?
Go on. In
salt water. D in Glasgow. Of course people can see underwater with no goggles. How do the pearl fishers, etc. in the Caribbean manage? I like this from Paul. Of course you can see in the sea. It's mildly salty. It's not soy sauce. James in Brighton. As a Brightoner, I spent a bit of time in the sea. I can assure you both that I have opened my naked eyes underwater on a number of occasions. Actually, the tears that your eyes produce have salt in them. Anyway.
Yeah, because you're crying.
Graham.
That's no defence at all. Salt water is like tears that you make when you're crying because it hurts.
Dear Simon and Sidekick, please tell the good doctor that, yes, you can open your eyes in the sea. It doesn't sting if that's what he's worried about, but everything is blurred, so no, you would not be able to spot a burning Spanish beard from under the surface.
Thank you.
And then he adds, not unless it was an extremely large beard, which was blazing anyway.
Yes, OK.
Mayo at bbc.co.uk. It's 5 Live at 3:34. Paul in Cheltenham just watched American Gangster. Absolutely fantastic Oscar-winning stuff, a classic cop versus crim movie, wonderfully directed by Ridley Scott. Outstanding performances by Denzel and Crowe, maybe slightly slow at the start, gets going fairly quickly. Once it does, it has your complete attention to the end. Also, I concur, Saw 4 is useless. That's what Paul thinks. What does the good doctor make of it?
Well, I mean, as you say, return to form for Ridley Scott, great big... sprawling, but in a good sense. What do you call it? Cop versus crim
cop
movie.
Cop v. crim.
Okay, the cop, Richie Roberts, but on the trail of Frank Lucas. This is fundamentally a true life story. Frank Lucas, who has sort of gone to infamy as the African American answer to the mafia. He was this you know guy whose career took off in the 1970s and became this sort of great drug lord in New York City. Here's a clip of Russell Crowe as the cop attempting to catch his man.
I had good information. Target of my investigation was bringing dope in on that plane.
And that target is?
Frank Lucas.
Who?
His name's Frank Lucas.
Who's Frank Lucas? Who does he work for? Which family?
He's not Italian. He's black.
Is that supposed to be some kind of a joke? You're this close to the end of your career in law enforcement. You're making jokes?
My investigation indicates that Frank Lucas is above the mafia in the dope business. My investigations also indicate that Frank Lucas buys direct from a source in Southeast Asia. He cuts out the middlemen, and he uses U.S. military planes and personnel to transport pure number four heroin into the United States, and he's been doing so on a regular basis since 1969. I have cases against every member of Frank's organization.
Frank's organization?
No black man has accomplished what the American mafia hasn't in 100 years!
So as you can hear from that, the kind of main thrust of this is nobody knows who he is. And according to the film, and what I know about him, I know through the film... he basically managed to rise to his criminal success on the grounds of anonymity. And the point at which things went wrong, according to this version of the story, is the point at which he decided to turn up at a big boxing match wearing a coat which is significantly given to him by his wife. And it's a standout coat that he keeps saying, never dress flash, never dress flash, never dress flash. And he turns up in a coat. So you interviewed Denzel Washington.
Yeah, he was on the program. And on that very point, he's going to explain here why the wardrobe was quite crucial in how he was discovered.
One mistake he made wearing this chinchilla coat to the famous Ali Frazier fight cost him. He was there with a lot of other mob figures and gangsters, and the feds were there also. The police were there taking pictures of everybody, and they were like, well, who's this guy with this chinchilla coat? And someone suggested, oh, maybe he's just a pimp or something like that. But they said, well, he's got better seats than the mafia guys have. So they took pictures of him. And as he says, that was the beginning of the end for him.
You put your head above the parapet and basically people start throw things at it. So now look, here's the thing. Ridley Scott's last film before this, A Good Year, was a total stinker and demonstrated that he does not do light comedy at all well. What Ridley Scott does is he builds worlds. And this film is very much, it's the world of America, of New York, late 1960s through the 1970s. And he has evoked that world brilliantly, partly referring to photographs of the time. Also, as you know, he says, because he remembers it, he was around at that time, Ridley Scott has a kind of photographic memory. It's strange. I mean, he is somebody who can see something once and almost perfectly recall the detail of it. And if you know his films like Blade Runner, which incidentally is being released again, re-released in the final cut in 2 weeks' time, the devil is all in the detail. Sometimes too much so, I think, with some of his movies. He really obsesses about the detail at the loss of the bigger picture. But here, the detail really, really pays off. Now, inevitably, the film walks in the shadow of a number of other movies. It's written by Steve Zaillian. It directly refers to The French Connection. In the beginning, it refers to The French Connection as a real-life case because they start off talking about what happened to the drugs from The French Connection, that after they were seized, they went into the evidence room, and then, according to legend, they found their way back out onto the street through police corruption. Later on, The French Connection is evoked. Somebody says, that guy, he's Fernando Rey in The French Connection, by which point they're talking about the movie of The French Connection. It's done very subtly, but it's done rather nicely, the move from it being a real-life case into it being a film, which, of course, is the similar thing which has happened with this here. And there are very clear comparisons between the character that Russell Crowe plays and the Popeye Doyle character that Gene Hackman plays in The French Connection, schlubby, difficult, awkward. Also, there's the ghost of the Godfather, because the central gag is that Frank Lucas's family life is much more stable than Richie Roberts's. While Frank Lucas has his family around him and his brothers around him and his mother, who is the strongest presence in the movie, Richie Roberts is all the way through the movie going through these terrible divorce proceedings because he cannot deal with, you know, with his emotional life. Then you have the Sidney Lumet stuff. I mean, like Prince of the City and Serpico, the problem that Richie Roberts has being this straight cop. No cop will trust him because he's straight. Because at the beginning of the movie, you see him coming across a $1 million stash and giving it back in evidence. They say, well, how can we trust you if you're not the kind of guy who will be on the take when we need you to be? Then there's, I suppose, to some extent, that goes to Goodfellas, the idea of the sprawling crime epic, and Heat. The good guy, the bad guy, who are sort of two sides of the same person and only meet very, very late on in the movie.
For me, was the final scene.
Yes, that's right, because you then had to leave early, didn't you? Because you had a job to go to. I think it is, to the film's great credit, that rather than being overshadowed by those movies, it acknowledges them and it knows that they're there, in much the same way as Danny Boyle said that when he was doing Sunshine. Of course, you know, you've got to walk a path between Solaris and 2001 and Darkstar. You know they're all there. You cannot avoid them. But what you can do is, you know, walk a path that is sort of bordered by them. And I think to a great extent that's happened with this. I mean, for a start, I thought the performances were really good. Russell Crowe, when he's good, he's very, very good, and he's the best that he's been here since The Insider. When he's bad, I do find him slightly insufferable. And there's something very good about the fact that in this he's playing a schlubby, difficult, downbeat, awkward, ugly character. Although when I said that to Ridley Scott, he did say, have you told Russell that? And I said, no, because the last...
We were there.
Oh, you were? Sorry, of course
It was live on the radio at the time.
You mean people were listening to
that? We were listening to
that. We were broadcasting.
It was you and me, Ridley, and the audience.
I just forget that this isn't just our life, that there are people. It's like being on a reality TV show with you and me.
It'd be very strange if Louise popped up every 15 minutes to bring us the latest travel
news. I just thought she'd like to keep us informed. And the other thing is that in terms of that, it's a long movie, but I was never bored. I mean, I didn't even think it started slow. I thought all the background stuff building up the story worked really well, because as the thing gains momentum, it really becomes edge of your seat, really intriguing crime thriller. In exactly the same way as Goodfellas, the pace goes from sort of, you know, nice and sorting out all the stuff in the background, it becomes increasingly hysterical, and then it sort of, you know, kind of builds to a climax, and then it knows where it's going to. And I was, it was a masterful piece of storytelling. I have very, very little complaint with the film. I thought it was a really good, solid crime thriller, well told, well played, lovely attention to detail, and great to see Ridley Scott back on form, because as I said, with a good year, I thought that's it, it's over, bar the shouting.
Just on our previous movie from Diner, and the important issue of pronunciation, says actually it's Beowulf.
Yeah, that's what I said. I said Beowulf run the tape back. I said Beowulf, or at a push, Beowulf.
Oh, look, Louise has got a dictionary.
Go ahead. My trusty BBC pronunciation dictionary.
I've never seen that.
It's kept very close to my desk.
Does it say controversy as opposed to controversy?
It says pronunciation too. Go on.
It does, and it's for an epic hero. That's what it is.
Go on.
Beowulf.
Yeah, see? Not Beowulf. Yeah.
Well, no, it's okay.
How did you say it?
Beowulf.
Beowulf.
That's what I said.
You didn't. You said Beowulf, like ginger beer.
You've changed that.
No, I didn't. Run the tape back. Find me a clip of what Simon
13 minutes to
you
four.
You said Beowulf.
Let's take some travel news now with Louise. Take it away, Louise. I'm sure I'm right on that. Alan, listening in Arlington, Virginia. Simon, I don't know how to pronounce Beowulf, but I'm pretty sure Mr. Washington's name is Denzel.
Denzel, yes. And in fact, I nearly picked you up on that, but I thought it would be churlish.
Too many tellings off.
Yes, exactly.
In 5 minutes. Tim, on this, I saw Once this week. Wonderful. I smiled all the way through. Only on in Swindon for 4 screenings, then onto DVD. What's going on there?
What was that?
Once.
No, Once. Oh, Once.
Saw Once
oh,
this
I saw
week.
Once this
the clue
week.
Was no, in so, the way...
No, but it was the way you said saw Once this week. As in, like, I saw Once this week, Bug. I saw Twice this week.
No,
Beowulf.
It's Once.
Yeah, I saw Once this week, Once.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good, that went down well. See, if only we had our rehearsal time, that's what we need.
Been sorted out.
Life should be rehearsed. Nida says, just thought I might mention this to help out the bad doctor, but in a good kind of ways, self-doubt about Eastern Promises.
Yeah.
He can relax because it's great. Mortensen is excellent. It's extremely well plotted and obviously better than A History of Violence, because A History of Violence was a load of pretentious, self-important tosh.
Okay. You know, you had me until self-important tosh.
Which is just wrong.
Yeah, which is just plain simply wrong.
So, any of the movies that we've mentioned so far, would they be better with our friends, Jason Isaacs, or Dave Morrissey, or Ken Branagh? would they be squeezed in?
Well, I think Ken Branagh would have definitely stolen Beowulf. But he wouldn't have done so well in Beowulf. Well, of course, actually, Ken Branagh in Frankenstein does sport the most fantastic six-pack. And we were talking about this about Frankenstein. I was him saying, you know, because he got a lot of criticism for Frankenstein. That was the movie that I actually learned to love him. It was the first one that everyone else hated and I really liked. And I, you know, and he referred to the fact that people said it, you know, there was something vain about him running around, you know, with his chest exposed and everything. And I said, yeah, but the fact is, you looked great. And he went, oh, but he did.
So some big movies. We've done American Gangster and the other one. Here's Weirdsville then.
Weirdsville, the return to the screen for Alan Moyle, who made his name several years ago with Pump Up the Volume. Christian Slater playing a sort of pirate DJ.
That.
You remember that?
Yes,
yeah.
I do.
Not the song Pump Up the Volume.
No, I remember
but the
movie.
Film Pump Up the Volume. Did you see it?
Yes, I remember.
Did you like it?
At a special Radio 1 screening, as I recall.
Oh, well, there we go. Fine. And it was a terrific movie. And then after that, he did The Gun in Betty Lou's Handbag and Empire Records, and things kind of went off the boil. And then he sort of didn't direct for a while, and now he's back, not so much with a bang as with a whimper. There is a problem with Weirdsville, is this. Any film with the word weird in the title, with the exception possibly of Weird Science, it's just, you know, films that announce their wackiness are really, really hard going because a little bit of wacky goes a long, long way. So this is one of those wacky stoner movies in which there's two guys, they're stoned, they're going to do a job, but maybe they're not going to do the robbery. There's a dead hooker, but maybe she's not dead, maybe she's not a hooker. There's a bunch of Satanists, but they're not really Satanists. They're kooky, crazy, friendly neighborhood Satanists. And here's the sucker punch. There's a carload of midgets dressed as medieval knights. And that's the bit when you go, fine, bailing out, sorry, no. Sorry, not doing that. Not doing that. You are now resorting to... It's so wacky and crazy and zany. Anyway, look, don't entirely take my word for it. Here's a clip in which the stoners meet the Satanists.
We were going to bury her, but we changed our minds.
Yeah, we weren't going to bury her anymore.
Not going to happen.
What are you? Are you like Satan worshippers?
Zip! You are not worthy to utter his name. But yes, we do bask in the light of the Dark Lord. You are not men. You are servo mechanisms to addiction. No better than automatons.
This is true.
I would be doing you a favor if I ended your sad little lives.
Actually, we're good. We're good.
We're
right?
Great.
We're
man.
Great. You know what?
Fantastic.
We're going to go this way.
Yeah.
Hey! Wait, back off! For both of you! Especially you, sister. You freaked me out! I'm not going to go crazy up in here!
And that's the level at which the whole film is conducted! Hey!
What is it supposed to be, then?
Oh, heaven. It's supposed to be wacky, crazy, zany, quirky, kooky, offbeat. You know, all those things. Oh, these guys, they're just so entertaining because they're all stoned, and the other guys, they're Satanists, and the other guys, they're midgets, and that's funny. And you go, no, none of the above are funny! You all had a great time writing it, you all had a great time playing it, you probably all sat in the bar at the end of a day shooting and went, oh, that was so crazy, it's so unlike anything else. Nobody's ever made a film with a carload of medieval midgets and some Satanists.
Why the high-pitched voice? Is that
because
the midget?
It's the sort of hysterical level of... the thing it reminded me of something a little bit was that film Big Nothing with Simon Pegg, which again, kooky, crazy, quirky, offbeat. I hate things that go out of their way to be culty. The sort of thing about which some peewit will say, you know, a cult movie, a cult classic. No. Cult movies aren't that. Cult movies are, you know, strange, perfectly formed but slightly flawed gems that get discovered by an audience. They're not movies that sit down and go, let's get all the kooky-quirky, you know, offbeat cult elements together. And it was really, it's like somebody scratching on your teeth or somebody making a sort of funny buzzing noise in your ear that at the beginning you think, oh, I'm going to be able to tolerate it. I really wish they'd stop doing that. And it gets to about halfway through the movie and you're thinking, I really want to slap everyone if they just don't stop doing what they're doing.
And so it's a bit like tinnitus, is it?
It is a bit like tinnitus. It is so that's exactly right. Santa Claus 3 was the cinematic equivalent of tertiary syphilis, and Weirdsville is the cinematic equivalent of tinnitus. And it's a real shame because I wanted to like it.
Where does that Jack Frost movie come in?
Oh, I think we're down to the special clinic in order to deal with that. So moving swiftly on to Brick Lane, which I know you've seen, adaptation of Monica Ali's novel about a young woman who comes from Bangladesh to the East End, and here she has to learn to find her cultural identity in an environment in which she is marginalised, one, because of her race, and secondly, because of her gender. She comes over here, she marries. You think it's a loveless marriage, but you're not entirely sure. Her husband, who is the father of her daughters, then has a very sort of ongoingly fractious relationship with the elder of the daughters. And it's to do with, as I said, with all of the characters finding their cultural identity. Here's a clip.
What is the wrong with you?
You mean, what is wrong with you?
From now on, no one speaks English.
You said that last time.
Behave yourself.
Get back to what?
Saro.
This is what they teach you at the school. This is what they teach you. I will not allow this to happen. Okay, Borita. To learn manners and to respect her father.
I didn't ask to be born here.
Sit. That guy, the guy who's playing the father, now I'm terrible on pronunciation, so I think it's pronounced Satish Kaushik, and he's really terrific, and a real scene-stealing performance. And he's great because on the one hand, he's got great pathos, and he really wants to be taken seriously, and he wants to be the sort of patriarch of the house, but it's all falling apart, and he does it brilliantly. The lead actress, Tanisha Chatterjee, who I think is a real discovery, I mean, actually she's fairly well-known outside of the UK, but she's terrific in the central performance here. Now, the main thing about Brick Lane is this. It's clearly a difficult novel to adapt, and I think they've done a pretty admirable job in condensing the action. What's important about it is, in the end, it's basically about a woman finding her own feet, and outside events intrude upon this. Like, for example, 9/11 happens, and this raises the spectre of racist politics, and there is an extramarital affair which happens, and actually all that really does is to encourage her to believe that she exists outside of her marriage. But at the beginning of the film, it's slow paced and it's a slightly dreamy, nice evocation of two different worlds. A lot of it's done in flashback. And that works well, but at the beginning you think it's going to be worthy. It's going to be, you know, worthy is a terrible thing to feel. As soon as you feel like something is worthy of my attention, you start to sort of sag a little bit. And at the beginning it is sort of rather slow-paced, but as the central character comes into her own, as she becomes an independent woman, as she finds her feet, the whole tone of the movie starts to become much, much lighter. And by the end of it, it's become very moving and very involving and very satisfying. So it's one of those films in which, I mean, it has got some very good reviews, and I don't think it's going to be a massive box office hit, although obviously the popularity of the novel will draw people to it. It's one of those films I would say you need to go in at the beginning being prepared to sit and listen and wait and pace it rather slowly, but believe me, by the time you get to the end, that will be worthwhile. The other thing is a criticism that's been raised about it, it's something which I have said about a lot of films. So people have said that maybe it's telegenic, that it would be a great TV movie, but why is it in the cinema? Now, I disagree. I think that, unlike The Queen, at the risk of incurring the wrath of Helen Mirren once again, and I don't want to do that twice in a lifetime, frankly, I think this does have real cinematic ambition. And the director came on, Sarah Gavron.
Sarah Gavron came on, yeah.
And I've not met her. She
was great. She'd never done a radio interview ever in her life before.
No, really?
So she was terrified, which seemed to be
very
strange. But she was delightful.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I think she's got real talent, and they've taken a very honest, very sort of, you know, solid approach thing. I don't think it's perfect. I think there are things, you know, wrong with it, and I think certainly there are moments at the beginning in which you feel like the pace maybe needs to be picked up a little bit. But it's a journey that you go on with the characters, and partly because I feel that it's so good-hearted at the beginning that you are willing to stick with it, and as the story moves and as the character develops, the filmmaking style develops. It's almost like watching a filmmaker finding their feet before your very eyes, and that I found really moving and really charming.
If you can see, on the subject of small screen and big screen, just quickly, Phil, on this, we were talking about Earth, the movie, a couple of days ago, because the director of that film was on. Said, my girlfriend and I went to try and find it this weekend, but we can't find it anywhere in Bristol. If you have any ideas, let us know. Well, I've got no idea at all. But if you can find it on a big screen, it's well worth doing. Yeah. Movie of the week.
Well, if you're going to see Beowulf, see it IMAX 3D. I would say movie of the week is clearly American Gangster.
If I can't, right, so if I've just got to see it on an ordinary screen.
Well, I haven't seen it on an ordinary screen, but I know that seeing it in IMAX 3D was the way it needed to be seen. Big, stupid, loud, in your face. Lion in your lap in every sense.
Thank you. Werner Herzog interview is available on YouTube and
podcast and podcast.
Don't forget the podcast. Don't forget the podcast if it still exists. Have a fantastic weekend and back on Monday at 1. And here, as an extra special bonus this week, our interview with Ridley Scott. Ridley, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you, Sam.
Just give us the story of Frank Lucas, because I think it's a story which will surprise quite a lot of people.
Yeah, it's 69 to 75. Frank Lucas lives in Harlem, used to be the driver and kind of hitman, if you like, for a guy called Bumpy Johnson. Bumpy was the king of Harlem. Bumpy dies, Frank Lucas takes over, becomes the fundamentally to take over from Bumpy's shoes. Frank realized that he needed... Bumpy was rich, but not, quote, white man rich. So Frank wanted to change that idea and got into the drug business and actually had the foresight and, in my opinion, balls to fly in to Cambodia, skirt the war that was going on in there, the Vietnam War, meet Chinese drug lords, actually do a deal buying, bringing back pure heroin retail, using American Army and Air Force transportation, shipping heroin in body bags and coffins. This is true. This is not fiction. That's a pretty extraordinary character. Amongst other things, Frank Lucas had this wonderfully conservative private family life. His mother was very important to him. The church was very important to him. And when he started to really move within his own organization industry, he employed over 30 cousins and nephews. So he was also a big family man.
So he's this conservative, respectful, religious family man who kills people.
Yes, in a nutshell. Out of that, that's a pretty paradoxical character, which actually was one of the main fascinations for me. I'd heard about this guy like 20 years ago, hadn't put two and two together till somebody sent it to me last year.
So on the one hand, then we have Frank Lucas and his story. Then on the other, we have the hard-nosed cop played by Russell Crowe. This is Richie Roberts. These are both real characters.
Still alive, would be on the set. Frank was on the set all day and every day. Richie would visit like two or three times a week and is now actually a kind of pretty busy prosecutor or defender. He's a lawyer. Richie was, think of French Connection, think of Popeye. You're coming out of the years, that's Gene Hackman. You're coming out of the years, like a couple of years after that story took place. And so it's that New York where the French Connection wasn't a Hollywood invention. It was a big name within the context of the, the drug enforcement part of the police department. There was a lot of corruption. Richie Roberts was incorruptible as a cop. In fact, was notorious, became, a leper inside of the police department because he found on a drug, bust heist, stakeout, $1 million, which in 67, 69 was a huge life-changing amount of money. And instead of distributing it amongst the boys, which could have and would have happened, he gave it back into the evidence room, thereby not being able, he could not be trusted by his fellow police officers.
So because he was honest, because he hands back this money, which we see in the film, that did for him, really, as far as his colleagues were concerned.
Kind of did him in with his buddies, and actually what happened is there was part of the DA's office that illuminated him, the DA's office, who came to him with a proposal to start a real drug enforcement office where he had to answer to no man, and that's what he did. And out of that, this kind of more or less coincided with this giant influx of what they called blue magic that was coming into New York at the time, and everyone could not fathom where this was coming from, and even more still, who was peddling it. They assumed it was Italians or coming from South America. They couldn't put two and two together.
And until Denzel makes a wardrobe malfunction.
Well, that's what's in the movie, but I think if you look deeper, if in that fight, the Frazier-Muhammad Ali fight, there were a lot of diamonds and fur coats present at that evening. I think what's even more interesting, Frank always reckons it was the coat. Frank Lucas himself reckons it was the coat. But I reckon it was his position. He was sitting the second row out from the ring. He was sitting next to the brown bombers, Joe Louis, who's a kind of friend. And when Ali came down, dancing down the aisle to meet Frazier, they stopped and there was an exchange where actually Frank Lucas shook hands with Ali. Off that, Richie Roberts takes that picture, wondering who the hell's this guy and how's he slipped past my radar.
So this is one of the key moments in the film, because up until this point, Russell Crowe and his colleagues really don't know who they're trying to tackle.
Worse than that, when he mentions the DA's office, they virtually fire him, saying, how can you imagine that a guy from Harlem, and they use much ruder words than that, can actually be, do something the mafia, Italian mafia, haven't managed to do in 100 years.
I think it's a terrific film. I know you've seen it, but I really, really liked it. I think one of the things that's really interesting for me is the film refers to the French Connection, both the proper case, because obviously there was the case was written up as a book, French Connection, in the 1960s. And then later on, a character says he's like Fernando Rey in the French Connection, by which point they're talking about the movie of the French Connection, which came out in 1971. And it's interesting because many of Ridley Scott's films are thought of as being, very visually lavish, visually stylish. That's often a touchstone. And what's fascinating about American Gangster is it has a very, I mean, it's very painterly, but it has a very gritty style. I mean, Owen Roizman, who shot French Connection, famously shot everything in what was referred to as natural light. And I for me, this kind of almost plays as a companion piece to French Connection. In fact, there is a plot connection, which is that according to this version of the movie, the drugs that were famously caught in the French Connection case by Sonny Grosso and Eddie Egan, mm-hmm. then did find their way back onto the street. And that's sort of happening at the beginning of this movie. So it's kind of like a, you know, a continuation of that same story. Very fascinating, fascinating story. And I think a really terrific film.
Thank you. Great.
Do you want to turn all that into a question for Ridley to answer?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were sort of gesturing towards me.
Well, no, well, ask an inspired question of one of our greatest directors.
Well, Ridley, we were
Don't just preach at us.
We were preaching at you is what I do very well,
that's
Simon.
That's true.
Ridley and I were actually speaking earlier today. Ridley, the thing that interests me is I wonder whether you looked back at The French Connection and thought, actually, you know, there's photographic inspiration there or stylistic inspiration there, because I see so much of The French Connection in the new film. Did you?
Yeah, well, Willie Friedkin's done two of my favourite. If you say, Willie, your favorite movies, you've got to say, well, what are my favorite, you know, 25 or 30 movies? Two of them would be Willie Friedkin's. That would be French Connection and The Exorcist.
Yep.
And
Simon's
think,
rolling his eyes now because you mentioned the
Well, only because I get it every week.
Yeah.
Right. So I, of course, looked at that, and of course, Russell and I looked at it and said, you know, we can't do Popeye. We've got to do something different. But if you look carefully in the movie, we actually got Russell wearing Popeye's shirt. He's got the Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah.
That's one of Popeye's shirts. I always love the minimalism of the original characterization of Popeye. You know absolutely nothing about his private life, other than one night, day he rides past a nurse and all you see is her legs and her white shoes. And then the next morning, Roy Scheider knocks on the door and finally he's chained to his
handcuffed to his own bed.
That's like called get a life, you know, because this is a guy who's actually obsessed with his job.
There's also a really interesting thing in American Gangster is the character that Russell Crowe plays reminded me to some extent of the work that he did in The Insider, because Russell Crowe, obviously, you know, he's a strapping macho kind of guy. You know, he's considered to be like one of the, you know, most handsome men on the planet. And yet what I like about him in this film is
he can do flabby quite
he's
well.
Schlabby, yeah. In fact, he's flabby, he's schlubby, he's pasty, very much like Gene Hackman in French Connection. He's a mess.
Right. So did you say that to him?
Did I say to him? No.
Did you ask him to be a mess?
No, I thought he looked all right, actually. I mean, you know.
I'm not asking him to go out with him, but it's just that, you know.
You're going to see him in the film I'm just finishing with him now, which is a thing we're doing with Leo DiCaprio. He put on 30 pounds because he's playing a politician. You know, Leo, Russell loves. Russell's one of the true chameleons. You know what I mean by chameleon?
Yeah.
In that they love to change their colors and they love to change their spots. And that's part of his job. Russell is absolutely a real actor who is not afraid to say, let's go up, let's go down, let me do this, let me do that, and brings those ideas to the table, right?
Yeah.
And to get the 70s look, which I think he had the definitive, you know, 70s haircut, which was pretty good. And I remember that. I remember trying to have one of those, right? And I think he looked pretty damn good.
I had the most frustrating experience with your movie, Ridley, which I enjoyed enormously, but I had to leave before it finished. So I have missed the last 10 minutes.
Oh my god!
So I know you're not going to, you know.
Where did you break out?
The key.
Have you been arrested?
Yeah.
The arrest has happened.
The arrest has happened, and
you
they
thought it was going to end there, didn't
it? It could have gone into a musical at that point.
Were you one of those people who rattle their keys and say, "Get the car parked before everyone else"?
No. It was. I had to leave to come and do this program.
I
had to leave for a very good reason.
I'll tell you what happens. He turns out to be a space alien, and the other guy's a woman in drag. It's great, honestly. No. And you missed it's a big twist reveal.
Actually, you missed one of the great scenes in the movie, actually, which is when they meet in prison.
No, you must have got through the meeting in prison with the coffee, with the teacup scene. You must have seen that.
Let's not spoil it for everyone. Just want to finish on a couple of questions from listeners, Ridley. This from Peter's listening in Prague in the Czech Republic. It's great to hear Ridley on the programme, especially as I consider the original Alien to be the best science fiction film of all time. Can you ask him, does he know if Alien 5 will eventually happen? And if so, could he please be involved?
Well, actually, Alien 5 I don't think will happen, mainly because they kind of, I think, attack the franchise by making Alien vs. Predator.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is the end of that. unfortunately.
Keith says, I know that Ridley's with you on the programme today. The biggest thank you must be to him for releasing Blade Runner in all its glory, along with many, many other people. I've been waiting for a collector's edition like this ever since first seeing the film when I was a student. It's also great that The Good Doctor's documentary has made it onto the box set.
I don't think it has. I don't think On the Edge of Blade Runner... Actually, Ridley, you can put me straight on this. I don't think that On the Edge of Blade Runner, which was the Channel 4 documentary that I made in 2000, is on the box set. I think... Hasn't Charlie Delarizzo made a new doc, Ridley?
No, what we've got... Yeah, he made a new doc. What we've got is a five-disc box of the new version, the version that used to run, and then a lot of very formidable two discs, which are menus and discussions... material that wasn't used in the film, and a lot of interviews, in-depth interviews with everybody, including Harrison Ford.
Ridley, we have to leave it there, but really appreciate you talking to us today. Thanks very much.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live